Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. A quorum is present. The first order of business is going to be approval of the minutes. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I make a motion for the approval of the minutes of March 12th, 2024.
All right. So is there any discussion? We have three sets of minutes, so he's going to make three different motions. But on the minutes of March 12th, is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 12th, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 12th are approved. Representative Bierman.
Motion for the minutes of March 13th to be approved, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Approval of the minutes of March 13th. Is there any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the March 13th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The March 13th minutes are approved. And Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, minutes for March 14th, motion for approval.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Minutes of March 14th. Is there any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the approval of the March 14th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and those minutes are approved as well. Thank you very much. So just to sort of set the table here, tomorrow we have an extra hearing scheduled at 8:30 in the morning in room 10, and that will be a walkthrough of the scope and licensure policy bill that has been posted, and in addition to other bills will be heard. So that's not a very long bill. It's the only things in it are things that have been heard in this committee. So there shouldn't be anything very mysterious about that. But there it is for you all to look at. And then as a reminder, amendments must be submitted to Mr. Sandy by 5 p.m. this afternoon. And then markup is Thursday. So just to make sure we all understand that. Okay. So the first bill on the agenda today is House File 4556, Representative Howard. And since he's not on the committee, I will move that House File 4556 be re-referred to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy, which is Representative Howard's committee. So Representative Howard, welcome to the committee. And let's see, I don't see that there are any amendments. So I think you can go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. House File 4556 is the product of a work group that the legislature authorized last year to study how we as a state, counties, all the entities that provide emergency rental assistance to Minnesotans when they are facing a housing crisis, how can we deliver that assistance in a more timely fashion so that we prevent homelessness, we prevent evictions, and we maintain housing stability where that is the case. So we brought a work group together charged with looking at the breadth of ways that both state programs and administered by counties and other entities provide this rental assistance. How can we improve processes that lead to human-centered, better results for Minnesotans? I was a member on that task force, and it really was a quality group of folks leaning in to talk about a really complex web of issues that often lead to barriers for Minnesotans to access emergency rental assistance. And so what this work group did is studied ways and laws and systems that we could sort of streamline and make a difference. And I want to highlight a few of the ways that the work group has brought forward legislation that encompassed this bill that's somewhat higher level, and then I'll stop there and allow my testifiers to come up. But we really sought to reduce barriers and improve access to the Minnesotans that are applying for rental assistance. We're seeking to improve access through simplifying language and verification processes. Also, seeking to proactively engage rental property owners and local administrators on expanding what languages are available. We're suggesting pursuit of technology improvements to enhance the accessibility of emergency rental assistance. We're suggesting to develop an annual assessment of need to help align the funding to meet the actual needs of Minnesotans who are experiencing housing crises, and enhance data collection to assess whether these changes are making a difference. And so I think I'll stop there and just say that the collection of the proposals in this bill, I believe, could are a mix of things that are short-term and a mix of things that are probably more longer-term, but collectively really could have a significant impact in preventing homelessness, increasing housing stability, and making our state a better place for Minnesotans when they're facing that crisis. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howard. So there is a testifier, Renee Ronnie, I might be saying it wrong, Rock. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, tell us how to pronounce it, and then go ahead with your testimony. Welcome.
Good morning. It is pronounced Renee Rock.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. thank you for this opportunity to speak directly to you today on HF 4556. My name is Renee Rock. I'm an enrolled member of the White Earth Nation, a single adult household falling in the 200% FPG income bracket. I'm currently living in a Ramsey County public housing unit after years of homelessness, and I am grateful to have and maintain my housing stability. Advocating for housing stability is an arena in which I utilize my homeless lived experience. I serve as a lived experience member of the Stable Housing as a Priority Collaborative, SHIP, a group that advocates for a prevention response system and ending homelessness across the state. It is important to state the need for a coordinated platform for the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, Emergency Assistance, and Emergency General Assistance Programs. One that will simplify the application process for both applicants and staff through the development of a universal, accessible online application. In my experience as a person using these programs, streamlining information gathering across those programs and minimizing redundant paperwork will significantly reduce the stress of applicants like myself and staff. Additionally, clearly communicating eligibility criteria and detailed information on required documentation will help manage expectations, reduce confusion, and alleviate anxiety. SHIP recommends implementing a trauma-informed approach in all communications and interactions with program users and embedding cultural competency into how it addresses diverse backgrounds. Therefore, staff training and language assistance services will need to be prioritized to eliminate language barriers and ensure accessibility to all. SHIP Collaborative finds the work of the We Are a Work Group to be commendable and would love to collaborate in every way possible and is open for conversations when needed. We have submitted a letter to this committee as well. On behalf of the SHIP Collaborative, we thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. So, Representative Howard?
Chair Liebling, I think I did one more testifier, Ellen Solly.
Okay. Certainly if Ellen Solly is here, welcome. I was just going to see Ellen Solly is not on my list, but it's fine.
Yeah.
Please come up, and I was going to also invite others in the room if they wish to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chairman and members. As mentioned, I'm Ellen Solly. I'm president of the Family Housing Fund. The Family Housing Fund is a nonprofit organization with 45 years of history of helping communities in the metro area address their affordable housing challenges. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 4556. The Family Housing Fund works collaboratively with stakeholders to address the barriers to help Minnesotans achieve housing stability. And we have years of experience working with the Emergency Financial Assistance System. Prior to the pandemic, we worked with the county court system to align resources to help families facing eviction. During the pandemic, we distributed more than $38 million of federal emergency rental assistance in the metro area alone. And drawing on those experiences, last year, the Family Housing Fund engaged stakeholders to join a process to reimagine the programs of Emergency Assistance, Emergency General Assistance, and FHPAP, the three programs that make up our safety net. At the end of our robust community planning process, we issued two reports, including one report with recommendations. And because of our work, I have a deep understanding of the complicated programs that families in crisis are forced to navigate, and a deep appreciation for the program administrators who balance the needs of many with limited resources. And I know at the current funding levels and intense demand that our emergency financial assistance system functions not as a safety net, but a lottery. The full report that Chair Howard talked about provides a roadmap for how we can build a system that ensures Minnesotans in financial crisis have a transparent and easy to navigate path for help, that it responds with the speed of the crisis, and that is funded at the level to ensure that it catches all who need it. This requires funding to support the administrative staff at the level needed to process timely applications. It requires investments in technology to help simplify the process for everyone. And perhaps most importantly, it requires collaboration amongst different state agencies and stakeholders. And this bill is the foundation for that reimagined system. So in the Family Housing Fund community engagement process, we independently came up with recommendations that mirror the recommendations of the work group. So why is that important? Both of our recommendations have deep support for broad stakeholders, and I might even say that that delivers a mandate for change how we do things here. And so I'm in strong support for the vision that the work group laid out, and I urge you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone, so we'll go to any member discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on 3.5 through 3.7, what are the current required documentations? Are there federal guidelines? And then what can we expect would be the alternate documentations that they're looking at?
Representative Howard?
Chair Liebling, there's a lot there, Representative Quam. What I would say, generally speaking, is what the what we're seeking to address here is each program that was identified, FHP or EGA, has sort of different rules, different documentation required, that often create barriers. So we're, with this language, we're trying to create enough flexibility for agencies to work together and to assess where are there ways to align programs, how do we align it with federal law, if there's some rules and things like that. But what we're trying to do is provide a little flexibility for agencies to dig really hard into the details and work together to come up with more accessible entry points for Minnesotans.
Sounds like smaller government, Representative Howard. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm disappointed that this is supposed to have been generated by a group or commission, and I would have thought that they actually would have looked at what are the present documentation requirements for all the different programs, where's the commonality, where's the difference, and have already verified what the federal guidelines are, and then would have a list of what alternative documentation might be required. So I guess I'm a little disappointed with that. But on the 6.11, making it so that the I'll actually read it. Allowing landlords to apply for emergency rental assistance on behalf of on tenants' behalf. Is there a requirement that the tenant be informed and be okay with that? Because having been on the Legislative Audit Commission for a long period of time, there's a great deal of hundreds and hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars that have gone into fraud, and that anytime we want to make things more easy, accessible for the people in need. However, we need to have some check and balance to verify that there isn't fraud going on. And there's so much documentation that there is. I guess I'd prefer to make sure that with this, there's the caveat that it'd have to be verified, you know, some checks and balances. So if you're, again, if you have this entity, commission, group, panel that's met and try to address this and improve it, it gives me a little bit of a pause that there seems to be a lack of detail and clarity and background information. So can you enlighten the rest of the story, maybe?
Representative Howard.
Sure, Chair Liebling, Representative Quam. Good questions. I would note one thing that we're saying in developing recommendations the commissioners must consider. And so we're providing, again, some flexibility for the folks that are the experts in this field to really work together. And so it isn't a mandate. I think that what we're trying to get at there is this was an issue that came up during the eviction moratorium and some challenges with Rent Help MN. There were some rental assistance programs that became more accessible if landlords could be the ones that sort of initiate a claim. You know, they already have some of the documentation that could help move it forward, knowing the amount of rent that's due, so creating that pathway. But the specific issue you're raising is a valid one. I think that it does make sense to have some sort of guardrails or an approval by the renter to so that it isn't sort of just a landlord taking it on. So I appreciate that recommendation.
Thank you. And let me just note, too, at this moment that as you all heard, this bill is going back to Chair Howard's committee. And just a word about the fiscal cost, because there is no fiscal note yet, but this is going to, any costs would be carried in Representative Howard's bill. So that's why we're sending it back to him. And, of course, it'll have to get a fiscal note before it goes anywhere, and then other changes can be made in his committee as well. Representative Quam, you had something else?
Yes, just quickly, a suggestion that when it goes back to your committee that you, I guess, find ways to make it clear that it prioritizes families with children, disabled vets, the elderly, people that would have more risk being homeless because of, well, obvious reasons. And so when you're coming up with developing guidelines and processes, I think it's key that we first prioritize those most at risk and most in need. And I'm hoping that, along with a few other things, this bill will have more clarity as it moves. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Nadeau and then Bonner. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Howard. Can you tell me in, I'm going to start on line 5.11. So emergency rental assistance application system must. It's designing this new system. Can you tell me how that is different from mnbenefits.mn.gov, which is currently being used across the board, I think most counties, and again, my lens is a little bit more metro, so I apologize to Greater Minnesota members because I think they would have different questions than I do. But can you tell me how you envision this new system requirement to be better or different from what is currently available that at least I know the metro counties are linked to?
Representative Howard.
Chair Liebling, Representative Nadeau, what we heard from program participants that have accessed rental assistance is that depending on the program, it is a sort of different door, so to speak. We did hear from DHS specifically about MN benefits. The idea here is to create and explore having one door. And maybe that door gets sort of split apart as folks go to program X, Y, or Z, but to try to have as clear as system as possible folks that are experiencing a housing crisis aren't sort of really left wondering, or if one county to the next, there's a challenge in terms of, or if they're seeking, resources through FHPAP for, which is more of a Minnesota housing led, that there's sort of this one-stop shop. And clearly, this is one of the recommendations that is, I think, more complicated, and it's why we have some reports in terms of the timing piece of it. It is one long term that I think would help address some of the barriers we hear from Minnesotans.
And thank you.
Okay. All right. You got something else, just Representative Joe?
One more quick one.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm curious if there's, I didn't see anything in here. A lot of this population is going to qualify for a number of programs, and I think that's what you're trying to address. But part of the issue that I see is we've got counties of financial responsibility, and that I think that's going to be a barrier to this work a little bit, but it's an important component. For example, I have a feeling that Cottonwood County wouldn't want to be financially responsible for, you know, people in Hennepin, or vice versa. And so there's a reason that we have some different, you know, onboarding. And in my county, we have a bit of a different benefit set than would happen in maybe another county. Not saying one is good or one is bad, but you know, local county boards have the ability to augment in certain areas and to do things. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that. And just in finalizing this, I'm very concerned with kind of this one size fits all approach. I know where you're going. I appreciate that. But I do pause at this. The counties, metro counties, are very different, and I really worry about people falling through the cracks if we try to do this one size fits all. I think that we're going to find conflicting benefits. There's going to be some populations that are going to be county eligible, where the county has decided that we're going to do something a little bit different versus others, and I just worry about the complexity of that, and I just hope that it's not that we don't waste a lot of time and energy and money when I think right now that DHS MHFA is working with counties really hard to try to fill these gaps. So that's my concern. So thank you, Representative Howard.
All right. So I'm going to ask Representative Howard to just make a note so you, in your closing, you can address it. Because, and members, when you tell me you got something a little, make sure it's little. Representative Bonner.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, I know you and I had some conversations during the pandemic about some of the challenges our counties were facing regarding housing. And so I appreciate that. And I think the expression is don't waste a good crisis. And certainly we had some pain points. But from that comes really unique opportunity. And I just wanted to say thank you for this bill. Because as I've always wondered why private or state agencies can't quite do the same things that private entities can. I'm an agilist living in a world where we do feedback and making things more efficient and quick to get to our goals. And what I love about this approach and the work that's been done in the meantime is that it really streamlines the process to talk about how we eliminate duplication, gain efficiencies, reduce barriers to approval and acceptance, and then, of course, meeting people where they are. And I'm really grateful that we took all of those into account so that we can do more to really streamline that process and take some of the pain and some of the barriers out of it. So I'm really grateful, and thank you for the work.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, Representative Howard, I would just say I really appreciate the fact, you know, I served on the homelessness division when we had that for 2 years as the lead on that. And I have expressed frustration many times about the fact that the title of the committee was Preventing Homelessness, and we did almost nothing to prevent homelessness. And I see the goal of this bill is to prevent homelessness. So I want to acknowledge that up front and thank you for that, because we do need to be thinking much, much more about that. At the same time, I share some of Representative Quam's concerns. As I read this, I would hope that having had the working group, that this would be fleshed out a little bit better. This piece of legislation feels much more like an aspirational document than it does legislation, which is frustrating to me. And I would just point out a couple of things. Things like on line 3.16, that the commissioner must create a resource. well, what does that mean? Is that an IT system? Is it a website? Is it guidance to counties? Like, that is really vague and unclear to create a resource. So is it a survey? That kind of thing I just think is not clear. I look at line 4.6. The majority of the bill is seeking a report and guidance for the legislature, although it doesn't always read like that. And on line 4.6, it says the commissioners shall develop and implement this plan. So implementation is happening before it comes back to the legislature, which I think is problematic. And then at the same time on line 4.9, it says they shall also identify their funding needs. So there are going to be funding needs, but they're already implementing before they have figured out what those funding needs are and before the legislature has appropriated money for that. I think things like that are problematic. I'm trying to skip to the high points because I think they're, like I said, overall this piece of legislation just feels sloppy to me. Like, it just feels like an aspirational document more than it does good legislation. I would hop down. Representative Quam and I were clearly on the same wavelength to the verification procedures. And I just have a lot of concerns. I mean, allowing self-attestation, while I understand that there are barriers and that there are difficulties, it's also a little dangerous to go to the wild, wild west and just say, well, if you tell us you are, then you are. That's dangerous. Also, this allowing verbal authorization by applicants, that puts a lot of liability on counties, on the folks who are administering this, to communicate with landlords. That's a lot of liability without any written consent to have those conversations, which I can imagine. I have to believe that our counties would be very concerned about. And again, the same concerns with allowing landlords to apply for emergency rental assistance on the tenant's behalf. Well, I like where you're going with that. Because I do think we saw that during the pandemic, and we saw folks who didn't have to pay their rent, and so they just didn't bother applying, which was hugely problematic. And yet, landlords were not allowed to evict, so it created a huge imbalance for landlords. I'm not sure that that's the same problem outside of the pandemic without that moratorium. So it just seems like there's some data privacy issues there. It allows landlords to initiate clearly they have to seek additional data for this to happen. It allows a landlord to initiate that. There's some potential concerns there. And again, line 6.14, they're adopting these recommendations by July 1st. So they have to prepare the recommendations by January 1st, and they're adopting, and it literally says adopt any recommendations by July 1st. That does not require legislative review. It does not require that the legislature look at this and appropriate the funds for us. It just happens according to this language. So, I mean, anything you can do to go through and just clean this up. I think that as an aspirational document, it's great. Looking for those solutions is great. But as a piece of legislation, I think that there are a lot of flaws like this that need to be cleaned up.
All right. Well, thank you. So we're going to go to a very brief closing from Representative Howard, like 20 seconds. And this is going back to his committee. And thank you, members. A lot to think about here. Representative Howard.
Chair Liebing, members, I would just say I appreciate the feedback. I think that there's a lot of value in this approach, and there's a lot of value in considering some feedback in terms of what ultimately proceeds. And I really appreciate the discussion.
All right. Thank you. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4556 be re-referred to the Housing, Finance, and Policy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred to Housing, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Chair Howard. Okay, Chair Noor. So House File 4106. I will move that House File 4106 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. And I don't think that we have any amendments today on the bill. Is that right, Chair Noor?
Yes, Madam Chair, there are no amendments.
No amendments. Oh, and I should say the first engrossment. So House Bill 4106, the first engrossment. Okay, well, Chair Noor, welcome.
Madam Chair, I think since the bill does no longer have the section related to judiciary, we are moving it to the Human Services Finance.
Yes, sorry about that. You had told us that. Right. So, all right, I will then revise my motion. So I will move that House File 4106, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. So Chair Noor wants it back in his own committee. So yes, we will do that. Okay, Chair Noor, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill simply tries to address an issue that we've all talked about. It's about the hospital decompression, the acute care transition, whereby we have got so many individuals who are stuck in the hospital. Members, this is an attempt to really reduce the avoidable days in the hospital across the state. What this bill does is a couple of things, three things. Number one, it expedites the SMART review process, that is state medical review team, for individuals who are not certified to be disabled by the Social Security Administration. So what it does is it allows, under limited circumstances, for the hospitals to send the referral directly to the state so that the determination for disability can be made for an individual who is in the hospital so that that process can move along. On the second part, as you all are aware of, we are dealing with workforce shortages and so many other things. It really addresses the medical assistance determination process. Imagine someone who's in the hospital who does not have the coverage that they need. So we are allowing the hospital and the other individuals who are involved with that patient to be able to provide that expedited process for medical assistance and many other things that can be helping that individual to acquire the medical assistance. And finally, I think the other section addresses the rate settings for individuals to be transferred in community setting who will provide the move from the hospital to a different setting. Madam Chair and members, that's simply what the bill does at this point.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair Noor. And so I think we have Danny Ackert signed up to testify. Oh, there you are. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here today in support of House File 4106. Hospitals have a singular responsibility to provide care to every patient that comes to them through their emergency department. Therefore, hospitals are relied upon to provide care to patients with the most acute and complex care needs. And it is often these patients, the most vulnerable, that consistently remain unnecessarily stuck in hospitals despite being ready for discharge. Too often, this is due to obtaining the needed government assessments and approvals to get benefits in place, to get access to eligible services in appropriate non-hospital care settings. In 2023, patients across the state spent roughly 195,000 avoidable days in hospitals, including over 9,000 days of emergency department boarding. The avoidable days significantly increased waits for other patients, forced some patients and their families to find care options elsewhere, and cost Minnesota hospitals and health systems an estimated $487 million in unpaid patient care costs. The unprecedented number of avoidable days is due to multiple factors, including significant delays waiting for a Men Choices assessment, the lack of available and appropriate supported decision making, including guardianship, and notably consistent delays in medical assistance application processing. Pending MA applications too often leave patients waiting in the hospital for weeks and even months after they no longer need inpatient hospital care. Such delays must be minimized as they directly impact our ability to meet our responsibilities to providing emergency and acute care to Minnesotans when they need it. This is a daily dilemma. As such, House File 4106 seeks to begin addressing medical assistance application delays by requiring an expedited process for hospital patients waiting for discharge that also require MA coverage to be admitted for their post-acute care needs in the appropriate setting. In the event information is not available or is missing to complete the application, the bill establishes an escalation process at the state and county to assist in obtaining the necessary information to complete the application in a timelier manner. Together, both provisions will reduce unnecessary application delays. In closing, we have received helpful technical assistance from the Department of Human Services, and we look forward to working with Chair Knorr and other stakeholders to advance this bill during session. We urge action this session. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone. Okay. So we will go to member discussion. Representative Newt Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Knorr. This is clearly, we've talked about this decompression issue. We both know that how important it is. I've just got two questions on one. This does create new timelines for state and counties. Has the department indicated, have the counties indicated that they have the staff to accommodate these new timelines? And the related question would be particularly to the counties. Do you intend to have a fiscal note to help, or excuse me, an appropriation to help pay the costs to the counties? Because it seems like there will be additional costs. So I don't think we've seen a fiscal note yet. So does the staff currently exist to do these things? And will we see an appropriation with this?
Chair Knorr.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, I think this bill is coming to us to really address that issue. We've got various bills, including the governor's recommendation addressing the acute care transition. So we're trying to find all the best solution to address it. So this is one of the vehicles. I think the SMART review process is done by the state compared to the county. But yes, when it comes to expedited medical assistance program, it may take some work for the county. So the key problem right now is when somebody applies and they're waiting for weeks and months, they may not be able to get the care that they need. They may not be able to be transitioned to a different setting because they don't have the coverage that they need to make sure that they can qualify for those benefits.
Yep, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Knorr. I'm sure we'll get into this more in our committee. I would just say I totally understand the problem. I totally, completely understand the problem of decompression, but I am concerned if we are forcing legislative solutions that don't that we can't accommodate. So does the staff exist? Can they manage these timelines is my only question. I'm sure we'll further that conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and thank you. And I would just say, Chair Knorr, thank you very much for working on this. I mean, we all know this is a very serious problem. We know it's a multifaceted problem, and it's even a nationwide problem. So, but for us to find ways to do what we can, because it's not only about the hospitals and their finances, of course. It's really about the patients who are sitting in the wrong settings and other patients who can't get the care they need. It's just very serious, and appreciate your work on this. So with that, any closing comment, Chair Knorr?
Madam Chair, you said it very well. We're talking about the most vulnerable individuals who are in need of help. So this bill will help those who need right now. So thank you so much.
All right, so I will renew my motion that House File 4106, the first engrossment, be re-referred to Human Services Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is going back to you, Chair Knorr. Thank you. Okay, Representative Lissegaard, House File 3992. And the chair will move that House File 3992 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. And there is a DE amendment, and I will move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the form in which the author would like to discuss it. So let's adopt that amendment, and then the author can discuss it. So all in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE1 is amended. So welcome, Representative Lissegaard, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill, very simply, is to get money out to ambulance services across the state of Minnesota that are struggling. And before I get into it, I just want to acknowledge you and Representative Backer and Representative Hewitt and Senator Seeberger and Senator Hochschild, others, had a wonderful opportunity, and I say wonderful, it's a very sad state of affairs that we're in, but it really opened my eyes. It educated me to know that I didn't know very much about the struggles that ambulance services and providers are having across the state of Minnesota. We are at a very, very critical point where services are about to collapse. And that's what this money will do as amended. It'll get money out the door while we work for long-term solutions. And those solutions will take many different shapes and will go through a process of its own. But our job is to, when they came to us, our job is to be able to help them provide a service to the people across the state of Minnesota. And this is not about Democrat or Republican. This is about meeting the needs of people. And so I'm proud. I have people that are going to testify. There is accountability in this bill for them. It's just not a free handout. They have to go through a process. They have to apply. There's checks and balances. They have to prove that the need is there and is warranted before they can receive anything. So with that, I'll just answer any questions and let the testifiers go forward.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Lissagard, and thanks for being such a great advocate on this issue for your committee. Clearly, everyone in the state of Minnesota who needs an ambulance should get one within a reasonable time, and the services should be effective and help them out. So thank you for championing this. So we have a number of people on the list. So Paul Peltier, and we can... And we'll have to ask everyone to be brief, but we do want to hear from you. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead. 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Paul Peltier, and I'm the executive director of RAMS, the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools. We serve a 7-county region in northeastern Minnesota focused on the Iron Range and the Northland. And we have 155,000 people that we serve and 15 school districts, 27 cities, and 27 townships that are our members. So we are very honored to be able to have hosted the task force and their work this year as they were doing their listening sessions. Thank you to Rep. Backer, Senator Seeberger, Rep. Hewitt, Senator Hochschild, and Rep. Lissagard, all members of that committee, and a part of the listening ear to kind of put a fine point on illuminating this problem for our communities. We know that this issue is important to everyone across the state of Minnesota, and we are very grateful that everyone is bringing their best intentions and their best will towards this issue right now. As Rep. Lissagard said, this is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. This is an everybody human issue, and that when someone picks up the phone and hopes EMS comes to their aid, no matter their zip code, they deserve to have that care that they deserve. So thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony. Jason Sinning and then Patrick Waletzko. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Sinning. I currently serve as a paramedic and ambulance operations coordinator for Stevens County EMS in Morris. I've worked in EMS, fire, and healthcare field for 17 years in a variety of roles, including ground ambulance, flight, home care, and administrative roles. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes to speak in support of this important legislation. As you're aware, this bill proposes $120 million in emergency aid to provide for immediate short-term ambulance service sustainability. The funding is desperately needed by rural ambulance services, especially those with run volumes under 2,000 calls per year. If this funding is not allocated, we have to recognize the very real possibility that ambulance services will be forced to continue to reduce services, response capabilities, and in some cases, cease operations. All Minnesotans expect, rely on, and benefit from the fact that all across the state, ambulance services and highly trained clinicians are ready to respond. As a state, we have to ensure that expectation matches with reality. Reimbursement rates through Medicare and medical assistance are inadequate and have been for many years. What this funding would do is stop the bleed. It doesn't address the underlying ongoing issue but it would provide immediate relief and allow us to continue serving our communities. We are all well aware that insurance premiums and deductibles are increasing. Increased deductibles mean an increased financial burden on the patients, while insurance companies continue to see profits soar and the amount paid to the ambulance service on behalf of the patient decreases. The amount of uncompensated calls our ambulance service responds to has increased by 300% over the last 4 years. Ambulance services are no longer able to sustain solely on the revenues generated from those that happen to use the service, nor should we expect only a handful of people to fund the readiness that an ambulance service provides to all who live, work, play, and visit our service areas across Minnesota. Continuing to rely on volunteers to subsidize the EMS system is unreasonable. Our responsibility and expectation is important as responding and provide life-saving emergency medical care deserve EMTs and paramedics that are compensated appropriately with respect to the financial aspect, but also when considering the time commitment, risk, and emotional toll that our jobs can have. I care deeply and am very proud of the EMS system in Minnesota, particularly where we operate in West Central Minnesota. We have excellent clinicians. The primary service area model ensures equitability, availability of service to all Minnesotans, and our innovation in clinical outcomes. As a state, we have always been at the forefront of the industry nationwide.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Patrick Waletzko, and then Eric Simonson, and then Cap O'Rourke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Patrick Waletzko, and I serve as the Emergency Management Director for Otter Tail County. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning to give testimony with regards to CFL 3992. On behalf of the residents and visitors of Otter Tail County, we urge this committee to take action necessary to protect emergency medical services throughout the state. Statewide emergency medical services have markedly weakened over the past several years. This weakness relates directly to lack of adequate funding to cover increasing costs, readiness, staffing, and reimbursement for services, while simultaneously addressing the rising ambulance calls. Many emergency medical services, regardless of their business model, currently face the financial hardship across the state. In Otter Tail County alone, our seven EMS providers have experienced an estimated single year loss of $1.5 million due to uncompensated care to the services they provide our communities. Gaps in state and federal reimbursement of EMS services are straining local and county governments to respond. This is neither sustainable nor does it address the root cause of under-reimbursement of emergency medical services. Otter Tail County strongly urges you to consider funding emergency medical services at $120 million. But we also recognize this is one piece of an overall puzzle, and further ask this committee and the entire legislature to address additional areas of immediate concerns, including funding of EMS service innovation, looking at designation of emergency medical services as an essential service, disconnecting emergency medical service reimbursement from patient transportation, looking at support for community paramedic programs, broadly funding emergency medical services education, and recognition of the exceptional challenges to rural services. I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Eric Simonson, then Cap O'Rourke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Eric Simonson. I am a lobbyist with Flaherty and Hood, representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We are here today in full support of House File 3992. And the reason why that we care is that if you look at the ambulance service licenses across the state of Minnesota, more than 50% of them are held by some local unit of government. We're very grateful to Representative Liz Lagarde for chief authoring this bill, and we're also grateful to the two dozen co-authors that have signed on in support of this bill, recognizing what really is the gravity of the situation, especially in greater Minnesota. Also grateful to the 41 organizations that have signed on this handout, which should be in your packet. It represents a wide variety of interests across the state of Minnesota that are in support of this bill, and it's definitely worth taking a look at. Over the interim, the summer, the fall, early winter, we spent a lot of time going across the state, visiting with our members, trying to really understand what the underlying cause of the problem is around EMS. And we heard the same thing consistently. It's lack of funding and it's workforce challenges. We also followed the legislative task force and their work across the state. What did they hear? Funding and workforce challenges. This bill is meant to address just that in a one-time fashion that buys us a bridge to get into 2025. There's two points that I want to make with the bill real quick. One is that the fact is it's a literal Band-Aid. It's simply meant to get us into 2025 when we can have a longer conversation about a long-term fix. Secondly, the $120+ million that's appropriated in the bill is not a random number. It actually represents the amount of loss that's experienced across the state of Minnesota. It's real, it's tangible, and it's here. I would say thank you, Madam Chair, and I stand available for comment or questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Cap O'Rourke? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We advocate on the over 700 cities with populations under 5,000. 90 of those cities currently operate PSAs across the state of Minnesota. These are some of our smallest communities that are operating an EMS service. And the reality is, as has been mentioned, that they are struggling. They have been struggling before this with reimbursement rates not keeping up with the services they provide. But with the workforce, critical workforce challenges that they are seeing now, it is becoming more and more a struggle. As Mr. Simonson said, this is a critical issue, and we acknowledge that this is simply a short-term Band-Aid, that there are bigger issues for us to look at across the state. But the situation is serious and is real for our smallest communities that are trying to provide EMS services to their constituents. We have communities that are, we have ambulance services that have struggled either through reimbursement rates or ones that have had to merge with others because of the lack of workforce. It is a serious issue, and it is an operation that you cannot simply merge with other and trying to coalesce with administrative costs, because the reality is you still need to get a vehicle with trained and professional personnel out to people in a short and quick manner. So we strongly support this bill, and we urge your committee to do the same. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Okay. We'll go to member discussion. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And thank you for Representative Liskard. I know we traveled the state, got up to the Great Mountain Iron area, which was a seven-hour trip one way from the hump bump tip elbow nose of Minnesota. But one of the things that I want to share with a lot of folks is greater Minnesota. I'm one of those individuals that would provide volunteer service for runs under 200 runs a year. And unfortunately, as I've shared before, us volunteers are subsidizing on these runs, and we're happy to do that. Unfortunately, last week, I'll use our service as an example. I'm down in St. Paul. My twin brother, who takes as much call time as I do, was gone. We had four runs last week, actually two on Thursday. And of the four, we had to have two of those runs came from an ambulance service 25 miles away. One of those runs, unfortunately, was an extremely good friend of mine. And I wasn't there for her. I was in St. Paul. Last night, the pager went off twice, too, which normally in the district, good, bad, or ugly, you get to see me, but I was in St. Paul. Of those two runs, one run was less than 1 mile away from where the rig sits in Browns Valley, Minnesota. Had to go 25 miles away from Sisseton to get an ambulance because we only had EMRs. The other run, fortunately, an EMT literally just got into the district 3 hours later. He was there for about 2 minutes. Pager went off. So we were able to help with that. These are the things that we're talking about, folks. And when we were out across the state, there are actually 3 hours. Retention, reimbursement, and recruitment are the challenges that we see. This is a nonpartisan issue, but I have to say I'm very disappointed with the governor's balance recommendation of only $10 million. We are talking about, when it comes to EMS, we are at the same crisis that the nursing homes. I know we don't have a lot of money here, but this is what happens. We need to prioritize EMS because we Minnesotans depend, when you dial 911, that you see an EMS. You see an EMT or a paramedic. I'm an EMT. With some variances, our services are able to do things more than regular basic service. So there's a lot of work to do. Representative Lissegard will know that this doesn't solve all the problems. A short-term bandage, we have to look at what I call the taxi runs. You know, those runs last week weren't taxi runs. Those were serious emergency runs. But we do get too many taxi runs where we pick up somebody and unfortunately we take them to the hospital so they can get their prescription filled. Yes, we have that, those type of runs. We have people who don't have a car to get to the hospital. We take those runs. Those are extremely frustrating runs for us EMS personnel because we have no problem when those are the serious runs. But the fact is I'm not a spring chicken. I'm 57 years old, and I'm not going to be doing this gig very long. And communities like Graceville, Browns Valley, Henning, Mountain Iron, Hibbing, even though Virginia, those taxpayers are subsidizing it through their property tax because they're taking the money out of general fund. Or like in West Central, we're holding pancake feeds and sending out fundraisers letters so we can raise $33,000. That's what our service did last year. So when the pager goes off, we can be out there. So this isn't a fix-all. It is a big ask. There are some concerns that I have with the bill that I'll continue to work with the author and several of the stakeholders. But this is something that's needed so we can do the long-term fix. So when your loved ones dial 911, they have an ambulance close by. Instead of what happened last night in Browns Valley and what happened last week in Browns Valley, where we had three runs that we had to call an ambulance service 25 miles away instead of 1 mile away. So thank you, Madam Chair, for a little longer. As you know, this is a passion of mine. I've been doing this for 29 years. Thank you, Representative Lissegard.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde. First of all, I appreciate the thoroughness of the bill. I also appreciate the reporting requirements so that we know how this money is being spent. I feel like the bill was done in a really thorough way, and I appreciate that. My question is, with the DE amendment, I know in the underlying bill you had appropriated $1 million to the commissioner for administrative costs. It's now a blank appropriation. What are you expecting to happen with that blank appropriation?
Representative Lissegard.
Madam Chair, if I could have Mr. Simonson.
Okay, very good, Mr. Simonson.
Madam Chair, Representative, very good question. The original bill, we just plugged a number in there just as a placeholder, not having a fiscal note yet. There should be a fiscal note in your packet, I do believe, that indicates an amount that was identified for the Department of Revenue to administer this. It's significantly less than $1 million. So in theory, that number could be plugged in there.
Yep, it's $57,000 in 2025. Sounds like a deal. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that because my eyes went like this when I saw $1 million for something that's not even going to require one FTE to administer this over the approximately year and a half that it has. So I very much appreciate that. That's good news. I will say, you know, I was listening to Mr. O'Rourke's comments. This is a short-term Band-Aid. And I have a lot of frustration. You know, Representative Backer said, you know, we don't have much money. I would say we don't have any money. It's incredibly frustrating that when we did this budget 1 year ago, we had the largest surplus in state history. We also raised taxes more than we have ever done in the history of the state. We had almost $30 billion to work with. We knew this problem existed then. I sit near Representative Backer all the time. I hear about this problem all the time. We knew this problem existed, but we didn't fix it when we actually had the money to do it. And now we're going to spend $120 million, and I do not disagree with the merits of the bill and of the program. But we're going to spend $120 million of money that we don't have, because we already know that we are in a, I get it, we're trying to rebrand, now we're calling it a structural imbalance. A deficit by any other name is still a deficit. It's not a structural imbalance. What that means is we don't have the money. And we're going to take another $120 million and add to that problem. That's not going to be able to go towards all of those underlying expenses that we have already committed to. And we ignored this when we had almost $30 billion to deal with the problem. It's incredibly maddening.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had thoughts along those lines of we just heard. But people in the audience and at home, this is why when we ask about having checks and balances to prevent fraud, it hurts me to no degree that I can explain when we have hundreds of millions of dollars go to fraud. And I know if we had an extra $200-300 million, how much we could help. And, you know, frankly, we need to make sure we do it right so we actually have the money to address these needs that get overlooked or get kicked down the road for another year. So let's do our due diligence in other areas so we can actually address this blaring need. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. So I'm just going to make a quick comment, and then I'll let Representative Lissegard make a quick closing comment. So, you know, this is a problem, yeah, that's been building for many, many years, and frankly, I don't really remember before before DFLers asked for that OLA report and started digging into this. I don't recall anything. I don't recall any Republican members having a bill on this for funding. Don't remember that. Maybe if they had one, they could give me the number. I don't remember seeing that. So, you know, we're all empowered to file bills. We're all empowered to advocate for stuff. And being in the minority is no excuse if you don't push for what you need, what you think is needed. And I don't think this is a partisan issue. And let's not make it one, you know. I don't recall there being a bill last year for a bunch of funding. And to go to the more positive note, I've appreciated a lot of the testifiers talking about this is a multifaceted problem. We have heard a number of bills this session. We're going to hear more to try to get at some of the different aspects of this. And I appreciate that this is a bipartisan effort. I appreciate that Representative Lissegard is leading the way on an important aspect of this. And, you know, when we look across our whole healthcare system, we got a lot of needs, lots of them. I mean, hospitals have been telling us they need money, too. They'd love to have. I'm sure if we said, let's have a bill for $120 million for them, they'd be thrilled. You know, we can do what we can do. And I do think there's a bipartisan agreement. This is a very important issue. We need to make sure that we have, as we change the system to make it more sustainable and better functioning, we do need to make sure that we don't lose any ambulance services that are providing essential service. We need to make sure, you know, if people have an emergency today, they need help today. So I think this is a good balance that we're trying to strike here. And again, appreciate Representative Lissegard's leadership on this. And so, final word, Representative Lissegard.
Point of information, Madam Chair.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, 3 years ago, I did drop a bill for $30 million.
Okay, very good.
Okay, thank you.
All right, 3 years ago. Representative Lissegard.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And, you know, you heard the testimony and you heard Representative Backer's heart and his experience. And that is what I heard across the state of Minnesota. And this bill was brought to me, and it was put together with the checks and balances from a bunch of stakeholders, including the AMC, who did an incredible job with this. And, you know, I'm not here to play politics. I'm here to help the people of the state of Minnesota, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I'd appreciate if you would support this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lisgaard. So with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3992, as amended, be referred to the Tax Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. And thank you to the testifiers who came down to testify. Okay, House File 4366, Representative Edelson. The chair will move that House File 4366, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Committee on Human Services Finance. Is that the correct motion, Representative Edelson, Human Services Finance?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is.
All right. Very good. So, let me see here. So, there's no amendment to this one, so Representative Edelson, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to see you all today. House File 4366 is the Priority Admission Law. A task force was created to address the 48-hour law. And I will just say that the people from the task force, so we have 18 members. It was hospitals, sheriffs, direct care and treatment, NAMI, community mental health, omnibus person for mental health, counties, county attorneys, commitment defense. We have been meeting about 2 days a week since session started to work through final agreements. There were several recommendations, and just so that we're very clear on this, civil commitments have risen in the state of Minnesota 50%. Since 2013 to 2023. We have a capacity problem on our hands. We do not have enough places and spaces for people to go. So right now, what we're seeing, if you looked at all throughout the state of Minnesota, we have people that are boarding in jails, that are boarding in hospitals. It is not the proper bed. It is not medically appropriate, yet we are here. So the Priority Admission Task Force, I applaud their work. They address many things, which will be addressed, and it is addressed in the bill before you, including immediately beginning to increase capacity at state-run facilities of about 10 to 20%. 10 people would immediately provide open capacity. There are many hospitals, I'm sure, I don't know who signed up to testify today, but there's one instance where somebody has been boarding at HCMC Hospital in downtown Minneapolis for over 2 years. There has been 150 staff assaults. This is not my problem, it's all of our problems. So the committee also formed a joint incident collaboration group to help facilitate discharges. They also talked about increasing services and community capacity. Some of that way would be to things like early episode grants for a person that has bipolar. Provide funding to administer mental health medications in jails. That is happening in some jails, but not all jails. It also relieves counties of some of the individual waiting costs to transfer to a state facility. It expedites Minnesota Section 1115 waiver application for individuals in custody, and it increases our forensic examiner accessibility. Madam Chair, I will just say that we have a meeting at 1:30 today to finalize some of the final agreements that I think that we have, and we will be amending this bill in the next committee stop. But it reflects many of the things that are in there. Some will come out because they will go in other parts of bills throughout these committees, but happy to take questions and go to the testifiers.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Edelson. I know this is a complex issue, and thank you for seeing it through. So we have several testifiers. First, I'll call on Sue Abderholden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. When the 48-hour bill passed, it was to make sure that people with serious mental illnesses didn't languish in jail after they were committed. It's also important to note that people are in jail for months before they're actually committed. For the first few years, it worked, but then an increasing number of people were deemed incompetent to stand trial and committed. And an increasing number of people in Minnesota are struggling with their mental health. So with increased needs and then increased number of people committed, the only people who can be admitted right now into state-operated programs are people from the jails. And yet, as you heard, we have people who are in community hospitals who really need to be there. The task force developed actually 8 recommendations. We need to make sure that we fund direct care and treatment so we can actually increase capacity. We need to increase the treatment that we provide in jails while people are there, especially injectables. We need to go upstream and prevent so many people from going into jail in the first place by increasing rates to community providers and funding voluntary engagement. We need to have new criteria for priority admissions, such as time on the wait list, intensity of treatment needed, safety of the individual and others. And we need to approve an exception to the current law to allow 10 people civilly committed from hospitals to get into DCT. While task force members are in agreement on many things, there is one big issue that remains, and that's whether we keep a specific time in which someone needs to be transferred out of the jail once committed. Timelines are difficult to meet, especially when we have lack of staffing, as we actually heard from earlier today. And I just want to be clear, from the task force perspective, this issue cannot be solved without increasing funding, both to DCT, the community, and the jails. I'll also mention that this is an issue across the country, from Washington State being sued and handing over $400 million in fines, but still not able to meet their deadlines due to no open beds. And in Georgia, just last week, they have legislation to actually do restoration services in the jail, because right now the wait time is 275 days. So I just want to say this is a nationwide problem. Our state has actually proposed a comprehensive plan to address this issue, not simply a Band-Aid, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Lieutenant Chris Thompson. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and tell us your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Representative Edelson for her hard work on this bill. It certainly has been a challenge, having so many passionate voices at the table, and everyone just really wants to do the right thing. My name is Lieutenant Chris Thompson. I'm the jail administrator with Cass County Sheriff's Office. I'm here today to give a voice to the county jails and the inmates suffering from mental illness languishing in those jails across our great state. There is a dire need to expand capacity of state-operated treatment beds, and this bill offers an excellent opportunity to invest in that need. Yesterday's budget proposal from the governor reflected a small investment toward addressing the issue, and I appreciate him for prioritizing the need to expand capacity. It's a step forward, however, it's a small step. In 2013, the 48-hour rule was established to ensure urgency, providing humane treatment of incarcerated individuals committed to the DHS. Because mental illness only gets worse in jails where there is little to no mental health treatment. Priority admission also allowed for us to tell people and their families when they could expect treatment that they need. We cannot back away from that urgency or ignore that this system needs timelines to ensure accountability. Chair Liebling, committee members, thank you for allowing my testimony and hearing my plea for help to expand the resources we so desperately need.
Thank you for coming in to testify today. Danny Ackert. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here today in strong support of House File 4366 as amended. In 2023, patients across the state spent roughly 195,000 avoidable days in hospitals, simply waiting for the right level of care to become available. The unprecedented number of days is due to multiple factors, but unfortunately it comes at a time when admissions from community hospitals to state-operated treatment programs is at an all-time low. Minnesotans who should be treated in a state-operated program often require disproportionate attention and care in community hospitals, including strict security measures best suited for state programs. Community hospitals are too often providing care in unsustainable situations where multiple assaults on staff are occurring, which require unit closures, limiting care for many to keep other patients and staff safe. With that, MHA strongly supports the following provisions in the bill. First, the immediate admissions exception for 10 civilly committed individuals waiting in community hospitals. This will immediately place 10 patients in the appropriate care setting and will free up community hospital resources to serve more patients. Second, we support the new medically appropriate priority admissions criteria, which will shift the admissions process away from a patient's physical location to towards the patient's care needs. This centers the patient and prioritizes limited resources based on best medical practices for care. Third, we support the voluntary engagement pilot programs and their goal of prevention and increasing community-based care. We also join in the universal support for increased access and capacity within states' operating treatment programs. As such, we support the recently released supplemental budget recommendation from Governor Walz to increase capacity at the St. Peter's facility. In closing, we look forward to continuing this important work with Representative Edelson. We are grateful for her charge on this bill moving forward as fast as she possibly can, and we look forward to working with the Department of Human Services and other key stakeholders. Action must be taken in 2024. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Matt Freeman, welcome.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, my name is Matt Freeman. I'm here on behalf of Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. Both of these organizations appointed members to the Priority Admissions Task Force. I want to thank you for this opportunity to support the final task force report and the work of Representative Edelson to codify that in the bill that we're developing. We look forward to continuing to work together to ensure urgent needs are met this session. Hospitals, jails, and those not being served in our community are all challenged, and urgency is needed to expand our state-operated system capacity and our community capacity to meet the needs of individuals in jails and with the highest acuity in our hospitals and community. A county and task force guiding principle was that all people living with mental health disorders are entitled to have care when and where it's needed. Specifically, people who have been civilly committed should have access to court-ordered treatment that they require to achieve recovery. County Coalition in a task force emphasized the principle that jails are not a replacement for mental health hospitals or secure treatment facilities, and a key objective was not to have mitigation of hospital problems at the cost of those who are in jails who have no chance to access inpatient mental health services. As well, the task force recommended that any changes to the prior admission statute must be accompanied by immediate expansion at DCT in the hospital capacity there. We saw the governor's budget reflect a modest expansion, and we ask that we continue to invest in the needed capacity at DCT. Any changes to prior admission law must happen simultaneously or immediately following capacity at DCT. Counties prioritized in this bill as well, ensuring that does not meet criteria dollars paid by counties are not sent back to the general fund, but that we're able to create a mechanism to return those funds to invest them in mental health and the needs at counties. And overall, we're committed to finding the best ways to address the current lack of high acuity placement options by working alongside the author and others. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. We have time for some member discussion. I should just note that we're going till 12:30 today, folks, and we have a couple other bills that probably won't take a lot of time, one hopes. So I'm not seeing, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill forward. The continuum of care for mental health is so broad, but this is a really important area, and I'm glad you were working on it and bringing this bill forward because it's just imperative. The sheriff talked about the fact that mental health does not get better in jail and prison, so this is working directly toward that, and just thanks for your work.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative New Brindley and then Nadal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson. This is so critical. It really is, and I 100% get that, particularly the priority admissions. I think that it was well-intended in 2017, but there have been some unintended consequences that clearly need to be dealt with. So I think that that is really helpful. I just have a obviously there are still concerns with the bill, not necessarily – I'm wondering how you intend to solve them. We're increasing capacity 10 to 20%. We're doing things, but where are we going to find people? How are we going to staff this? That's the million-dollar question.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think that's a good question. I mean, right now, that is why it will take years, honestly, to build the capacity that we really truly need to address the increase in civil commitments that we've had in the state of Minnesota. But as our Ms. Afterholden said, this is not a Minnesota, this is across the U.S. The one thing that I will say as we're going through the ongoing, and I think we actually are at a point where we have an agreement, how long it, and how effective that agreement will be, I think we will see. You guys will see when I'm here next year, as hopefully somebody will come back with a report. But what I would say is one thing that was not addressed in the priority admission law is the 48-hour rule explicitly. And so while we have, I want to thank all of my testifiers, genuinely everybody has done a great job negotiating. And as the sheriff said, we have had some tense conversations. What I will say is the 48-hour rule was not explicitly addressed, and that needs to be done. I think it was well-intended, but the reality is I don't think the intention was that somebody sits in a hospital, because that is not the medically appropriate bed for 2 years with 157 nurses assaulted, right? That's not right either. So we will be extending the same task force to come back to this legislature next year to address specifically the 48-hour rule. And I will say that my office has, we've done research to try to see what other states are doing. Do they have time frames? We've seen 30 days, but that's about it. There's not a lot of statute around a turnaround like this. And I will say it will cost our state, because there will be litigation after litigation, and that will remove our ability to actually intervene in mental health ways that are going to be productive, because we'll be paying lawsuits. We have to be realistic in the legislation we pass. So I think it's a great question that you ask, Representative. I don't have 100% an answer that will solve all of this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I think that certainly, like I said, portions of this bill can be resolved, you know, are helpful regardless of what happens with staffing. I mean, even just the adjustments, you know, clearly somebody who's been in a hospital setting for 2 years needs to be bumped up the priority admissions list, right? So, and I think this bill resolves that regardless of additional staffing and that kind of stuff. So I think that is helpful. So I think it does solve some problems, but I have concerns that we talk about increasing capacity, but if we don't, our problem is staff, it's not space. We have space, we don't have people. And I'm not sure that we get there with this. Just one other question and then a comment. A number of places throughout the bill, It directs the commissioner to seek to fund different things. I'm wondering just what that phrase means, to seek to fund.
Madam
Representative
Chair.
Edelson.
Madam Chair, you know, I know that we have DHS here. I don't know where they are. My eyes are not. They're here somewhere, but they have maybe. There we go. Mr. Burdick is here. Maybe he could speak to these. So it's a big bill, Representative. So, yeah, let me see if we can. Yeah.
Mr. Burdick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. Representative, can you just point me to the section of the bill you're referring to?
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure. At least two examples of that language. I've got to scroll up here. On page 4, lines 4.10 to 4.12, the Department of Human Services must seek to fund eligible providers of first episode psychosis and assist with program establishment throughout the state. And I believe, if I remember right, I had that marked again on page 5, 5.22, the Department of Human Services must seek to fund eligible programs throughout the state.
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe this is language that was actually being put forward by the advocates. These are either establishing or modifying two grant programs, and then later in the bill there is an appropriation that would correspond to that, but I would invite the folks that were working on this to speak to it.
Ms. Afterholden wants to explain that. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sue Afterholden with NAMI. This is because these are grant programs, and originally the way that it was worded is that the that the current providers had to meet the needs of rural Minnesota, which doesn't really work because it's an intensive program, the first episode program. So we wanted the department to actually seek to fund programs in rural Minnesota. So that's why that is there. But these are actually existing programs. We have now 5 first episode programs in Minnesota.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's odd language, right? For the legislature to pass to seek to fund something, we either appropriate money or we don't. That's what we do here. So you might want to consider what that means moving forward, because that is odd language to give to the department to seek to fund something. As you indicated, you are funding some of those things through grant programs in your appropriation section. The last thing I would ask is, in the appropriation section, I believe there are 8 different appropriations. And as I look at these appropriations, they do things like create a staff position at Direct Care and Treatment. They pay for injectable medications. They reimburse county boards for co-payments. They directly increase the pay rate for forensic examiners. They do a lot of really important things. However, only 3 of these appropriations, and interestingly, it's the 3 appropriations for the grant funding, which really could or could not be ongoing, right? Ideally it is, but it could or could not. Those 3 appropriations go into the base. All of your other appropriations do not go into the base. Now, we don't know yet. Some of them are blank appropriations, so we don't know how much these will be. But you are requiring adding staff with no base funding into the future. You are requiring significant increases to a pay rate for forensic examiners, almost twice the current pay rate, with no appropriation ongoing into the base for those things. How doesn't this create a fiscal cliff for some of those things?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. As I stated earlier in my testimony, this is an ongoing negotiation that's happening behind the scenes. We don't have time to go and say this is exactly what's going to happen. I took, at the very beginning, when the task force came out with a report on February 12th, which was the day that we started session, I took that, I grabbed all of the recommendations, and I put it into a bill. Now, what will happen with the actual bill before you is we just met last week with some negotiations that were almost down to the one last provision. Many of what you're talking about is going to go into other omnibus bills, and so it's not going to end up in the final bill for the task force recommendation, because hopefully it will be done in other places, which I'm also navigating. So what actually will be in the final bill, which will be amended next week, will be something different than what is necessarily here. But these are all of the things that the task force has talked about. What we can actually do and what will actually end up in the final bill is not exactly what's here. We are going to be talking about a pilot program for medications this afternoon, and making sure that jails have some supports. So the final fiscal aspect will be discussed in the committee next week in Human Service Finance.
And I think Representative Fish has a comment to this point.
Yes, thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for the work that you've done on it. We've heard this in my committee. We also have a mental health component that's going to be coming out, recommendations. One of the things that we heard very clearly was on the episode for psychosis, we're trying to do something along those lines. These will be recommendations that will be coming to this committee here. We've got a package bill we're putting together. One of the critical things that I also heard during the presentation, having talked to people after your bill was presented, is that one of the problems we have with the Department of Corrections and Treatment is sometimes they're backed up because the other parts of the system aren't there. They're ready to discharge. One of the big things that I heard very clearly is we need to address our rates, and that's one of the recommendations we have coming out in our bill. We'll be hearing in my committee tomorrow, and then it'll be passed on to this committee here.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I hope that as part of that consideration, we're talking about increasing rates. I do have a concern when we're talking about increasing rates for direct care and treatment. We've got to walk a delicate balance, because we certainly do not want to pillage our disability folks, our PCAs, the other folks who are working in this space, because we're going to create other problems.
by doing so. So I think we have to be very cautious in how we go about doing that. And I would also just say, you know, frankly, regardless of where these appropriations are going to end up, they may end up in other spaces. We still have to have an understanding if they're going into base funding or not. And frankly, if what we are doing is are ongoing items, you need to have ongoing funding. And again, while this is a really critical bill, I sure wish we knew this was a problem last year, and I sure wish we would have solved it when we had money, because we don't now. So perhaps another thing you could think about is looking at that, at the budget that was passed last year, and figuring out where you can pull that funding so that we have that money to pay for these critical pieces moving forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm going to go to Nadeau and then Quam, and then we're going to vote on this bill. So, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair. I want to start on 38.11, and thank you, Representative Edelson. This is really hard work, and it's complicated. 38.11 basically talks about how counties are now have the ability to request reimbursement for medication, but DHS doesn't have to pay them. Is that what we're doing?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. You know, with us, we just had a discussion on the copayment obligation, and I'm trying to remember if I phone a friend in terms of Mr. Freeman or Ms. Abderholden. We're trying to work through this in terms of the cost of all of the pieces of the bill.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Doe, Sue Abderholden with NAMI. So the issue is that we have an appropriation section to help pay for the medication. And so if we're paying for the medication, then the county shouldn't be asking for a copayment. So we're trying to work through those very, you know, two different sections of the bill, actually later today at 1:30 to figure that out. But the original intent was that if you already have someone who doesn't want to take their psychiatric medications and you're going to ask them to do a copayment, that could then become a barrier. And what we want them to do is actually take their medication and not have that barrier.
Yep. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I mean, just to be clear, I don't think that jails, correction, you know, I don't think jails are a place to deliver mental health services at all. So, I mean, I think the biggest part that's missing in this bill and any of the appropriations are, I mean, and last year when we had money last year, we basically changed shall to may, allowing DHS to have an affirmative defense against the lawsuits that they were being charged with under the current law. And now we're basically trying to go around the edges of this thing and say, well, hopefully we'll get there at some point. But there's people languishing in hospitals, they're languishing in jails because we, the legislature, doesn't want to prioritize a proper placement for these folks who need treatment. And I appreciate the work that's being done, but this, you know, the fact that we may get an appropriation, counties may be able to, you know, apply for reimbursement. It's just profound to me. Line number 32.25. In this one, Madam Chair, we're talking about reimbursements again. And my question for this 3.24 to 3.30, I'm sorry, 32.24 to 32.32. So if in fact we don't get federal approval, does this mean that we're going to claw back money from providers? Is that what this is talking about?
Representative Piddleson.
Madam Chair, this is the rate section of the bill, and this actually will be coming out, Representative, in terms of all of the things that you're seeing here and that we could have funded it last year. I will just say, at the end of last session, I was running around, me personally, making sure that we had a task force on this issue. So everybody gets to come to this committee like they're the hero. I made sure I made sure we did it. And I made sure Mohammed Chair Noor made sure that it went into the bill, because this was an issue that was starting and it was a problem. And yes, an appropriate bed is not a jail. We all agree to that. Those are the tense conversations we're having, but unfortunately, we do not have capacity. And if we don't change some of how this is done and what was done last year in terms of the language of the 48 hours, we will be sued every single day for every single patient. We do not, this is a problem that is all of our problem. And so if I welcome you, Representative, to our meeting at 1:30. And if you have a lot of great ideas on that, come join me. There's a lot of us that are trying to work really hard on this problem, and we would welcome bipartisan support.
All right. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one thing that did bother me was this bill is going to be, pieces are being put off into other bills, other, you know, it's being split up. And because of the importance, I think you need all the pieces in one place and focused on as it goes through the committee, because I've seen too many times when you have a little bit here, a little bit there, the pieces don't fit together when they're finished and off the floor. So that's my suggestion, is try and keep a coherent full bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So with that, Representative Edelson, do you want to say anything? I think we could just move to vote, unless you really want to say something.
I do.
Okay. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4366, the first engrossment, be re-referred to Human Services Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. On to Human Services Finance. Thank you for all the work, Representative Edelson. Okay, we're going to switch up the gavel here a little bit, and Representative Smith is going to, and I misspoke before, we actually have three bills, and two of them are mine. So if it's okay with everybody, he's going to start, we're going to start with the Bierman bill and then go to the two that are mine. And here we go.
All right. The face is changing, but Olmsted County is still in control, so no one worry. We are going to move on to Representative Bierman's bill. This is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Bierman, I believe you'd like to move House File 4187. And there is a DE amendment. And so, the chair will move, or Representative Bierman. Okay. We're getting
Thank
used
Mr.
to this.
Chair,
Representative Bierman, go ahead.
I would like to move the DE1, please.
Absolutely. Wonderful. We're going to go ahead and vote on this to get it in the shape that the author would like. So all in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes. It is in the form you would like. Representative Bierman, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the committee's time to hear House File 4187, which creates an alternate hospital inpatient payment rate for Gillette Children's, a specialty children's hospital serving children with disabilities, rare disease, complex medical conditions. Members, this is a one-time fix for a very specific set of circumstances to preserve Gillette's funding because of a unique situation with a long-term inpatient stay. The Minnesota Department of Human Services provided technical assistance in drafting this language intended to be budget neutral. This language prevents Gillette's Children's from losing over $7.3 million in 2025. This represents almost 50% of Gillette's inpatient fee-for-service medical assistance payments. The $7.3 million includes the federal Medicaid match, and it has already been paid to Gillette as a medical assistance payment for the 2021 rate year. This is not new money. Mr. Chair and members, In light of time, I would like to skip the 10 more paragraphs of detail I have on this bill. I don't think it will make it necessarily clearer for any of you. And I do know that many of you have spoken directly with Gillette or with myself about this bill. And I want to thank Rep. Schumacher for being an author on this bill, and Rep. Murphy and Rep. Elkins. And just note that Rep. Schumacher has authored bipartisan legislation in the past to prevent Minnesota's freestanding Children's Hospital from losing millions of dollars due to a proposed rule from CMS making significant changes in the methodology that is used. And this issue is sort of a sister to that work, so thank you, Representative Schumacher. So I do have the Gillette CFO is here and other folks from Gillette if you would like to take a deeper dive or if there are questions. But I think with the number of conversations members have had and the bipartisan nature of this, I think we have the ability to just move it forward and lay it over.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. I'd also like to ask, is anyone in the public here would like to testify on this bill? This would be the time to step forward. All right. We will move right to member discussion. Do we have any member discussion or questions? Not seeing any. Representative Bierman, you're doing a great job. And with that, I think we will say that, or we're voting or no? All right. So Representative Bierman is going to renew his motion that House File 4187 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. As amended. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, we are moving right along. Representative Liebling, Chair Liebling, is going to move that House File 4396, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Chair Liebling, I'm going to pass it over to you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And there is an A2 amendment that I would like to adopt to get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Wonderful. Rep. Liebling is going to move the A2 to put the bill in its intended form for discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So I am going to ask, I have some testifiers here, and I am going to let them come down. But as I get ready here, I just want to say that, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about some of the struggles that our hospitals are having. And so this is, a modest bill, but one that is just intended to assist with some of those struggles. So I will turn it over to my testifier.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Liebling. And to the testifier, please identify yourself and give your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Marnie Falk, and I'm the Director of Public Policy at Gillette Children's. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for authoring this legislation. In 1994, the Minnesota Legislature established essential community providers. This designation is a recognition that healthcare providers that serve, per the statutory language, high-risk, special needs, and underserved individuals are essential to those they serve, and that health insurance networks should not limit access to these providers. Essential community providers are located throughout the state. Examples include many mental health clinics, community health centers, and hospitals including Hennepin Healthcare, Children's Minnesota, and Gillette Children's, hospitals serving patients from counties across Minnesota. Health plans are required to offer a provider contract to any designated essential community provider located within the area they serve, and current law includes a provision requiring health plan rates to be at least the same rate per unit of service as is paid to other providers for the same or similar services. This is not currently happening in all cases. This legislation clarifies current law to ensure essential community providers are given the opportunity to be included in all state-regulated products offered by a health plan, and that they are paid a reasonable rate within individual, small employer, and large group networks. We have been working with Chair Liebling, state agencies, and stakeholders on the right language to provide clarity and look forward to continuing those conversations as this bill moves through the process. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Director Falk. Next up, I believe we have another testifier. You could identify yourself and then present your testimony. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. So this issue was brought to us a few weeks ago, so we're still looking into it and looking at the language that was adopted today. You know, we're not quite at the proverbial peace in the valley on this, but we are committed to working with stakeholders on this to work out the situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're always looking for peace in the valley. Any other members of the public that would like to testify on this bill? All right, then we are going to move to member discussion and questions. Not seen any. Thank you for taking it easy on me, everybody. So we're going turn it over to Chair Liebling for the last word on this bill.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair, doing a great job. And so this bill would just be laid over and work can continue, and hopefully we can get to that proverbial peace in the valley.
All right, wonderful. So House File 4396, the first engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. And we're going to be moving right along to another Representative Liebling bill. She is going to move that House File 4571 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Representative Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this is a essentially an error cleanup bill. So this is there's a lot of pages in the bill, but most of it are just current language. This is the appropriations article from the bill that we passed last year. And if you look on page 12 of the bill, you see some language added about a grant that we passed that we had on the spreadsheet, but that we inadvertently dropped the language out of the bill. So this is something that Chair Wicklund and I had agreed to correct so that this organization could get their grant. And so this is just the correction. And just for members' interest, too, this will be the base bill for our omnibus finance bill this year.
All right, wonderful. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Anyone from the public who would like to testify on this bill? All right, and once again, it looks like no one. And so we'll move on to member testimony or questions. All right, thanks, everybody. This is great. House File 4571. Let's go back. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to say, Chair Liebling? All right, so let's say that House File 4571 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Afternoon, everyone gets a little less chatty. Our next meeting is going to be Wednesday, March 20th, tomorrow. Remember, we have an 8:30 a.m. meeting. And I believe with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Yay.